أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وبه نستعين، إنه خير ناصر ومعين. ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. My respected elders, sisters, brothers in Islam and Iman, Salamun alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'd like to begin by thanking Allah for the opportunity to be here on this very important night of the first of the new year in the Islamic calendar and the first of the month of Muharram. The new year, as was mentioned, is a time for reflection, as certain planetary bodies have moved and completed certain cycles. And things are moving out there. We have to ask ourselves, as individuals, how are we moving? Is it the case that as movement takes place in the universe, that we are making movement and progress in that journey for which we were created to take? It's a cause for pondering, a cause for reflection. And this being the month of Muharram, it's a cause for grief as well. We're told in hadith that Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam says that when he speaks of his father, the Imam, his guide, he says that when my father, we would see that when the month of Muharram would arrive, his entire mood would change. There would be no smile to be seen from my father. And as the days and nights of Muharram would pass, his grief would intensify until it got to the day of Ashura, where his grief would reach an epitome. And he would say that this is the day that my grandfather Hussein alayhi salam was martyred. And we thank Allah for this opportunity to be able to once again commemorate this great event. And when I say great, I use that word out of choice, because truly the importance of this particular event is not something that I at least cannot fathom it. It is something which is pivotal, something which is necessary, something to which we owe a tremendous amount of respect. Before I begin the topic, I just wanted to say a special thanks to the community here for welcoming me during this time. Alhamdulillah, it is an honor to be a service to the Imam of the time, inshallah, by being here with you. And I especially would like to thank those of you who reached out to me even before my arrival to set up various programs, to coordinate various things, the management committee, the youths, the volunteers, other individuals, other organizations, to know that there's so much desire and so much opportunity for the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt to be spread in this community is indeed a great joy and a great pleasure and a source of being thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The topic that I've chosen, inshallah, to address is that of living in a culture of instant gratification. What I'd like to do tonight, inshallah, is to spend a bit of time introducing this topic. And then I'd like to go back to this issue of it being the first of Muharram and discuss a few points relating to our commemoration of the month of Muharram as an introduction. Inshallah, in the future nights, we'll focus exclusively on the topic of living in the culture of instant gratification, but tonight we'll focus a little bit and then divert to this event that we're commemorating. And inshallah, we'll end with the musibat of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn al-Salam. Peace be salawat ala Muhammad. The topic I've chosen to discuss is living in a culture of instant gratification. And there's a few points I want to make about how it is that we're going to address this topic. First of all, the approach that I'm going to take is primarily to rely on the Qur'an and the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And throughout the course of the lectures, those of you who will be here, inshallah, you'll notice that I will refer and actually quote from the Qur'an and hadith. And this is for a reason, because it goes back to a certain belief that I have, and I believe that you share with me as well, and I would like you to, inshallah, share with me, which is that Islam is a complete religion that has a solution for all of our problems. It gives us a way of living, and even within Islam we find the sources of advice and the guidance that we need to be able to address even the most modern of issues, like the issue that we're going to be discussing, which is a culture which is based on instant gratification. I won't be looking to quote from self-help books or from, I don't know, new religion books or other type of sources. Not because there's, not to say that there isn't nothing that we can find from those that's useful, but rather because I don't see any need to do so when we have rich teachings from the Qur'an and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And inshallah, as we go along, I hope that you will appreciate this point, that even the most modern of issues can be found to be addressed within the principles that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam have given us. The second point I want to make about the way that inshallah we're going to be doing these lectures is that I, at least, do not plan on saying anything which is offensive in these lectures. What I mean by that is that Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala is an individual and an event where we do not have the right to enclose it and confine to any one space or any one group of people. It's a universal message and it's for everyone to be able to share and participate in. And therefore the nature of the words I'm going to be using, the analysis I'm going to be making, is not going to be offensive to anybody. And therefore I encourage those of you who are putting on the rest of the program to also follow in the same spirit, and for you to invite other people to share in this great event that we are having the blessing of commemorating. Those of you who have friends who are from our brothers and sisters of the Ahlul Sunnah, invite them. So they come and see what it is that happened to the grandson of your beloved Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And the third point I want to make about the lectures is that the points that I will make are meant to be reflected upon. They're meant to be discussed. I encourage you to discuss them. When you're going home, driving home, talk with your family. You're sitting over the dinner table, discuss them. Thinking about them as well too. There'll be suggestions that I will offer Most of the time, these suggestions aren't coming from me. They're coming from my teachers, who are teachers of the Hawza of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. They themselves got those points from their teachers, who they themselves got those points from none other than the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So these are not coming to you, and they're meant to be, meaning just like that, they're meant to be thought upon, they're meant to be pondered upon as well too, and acted upon as well. Maybe the case that there's something which is new to you, confusing to you, how to apply it, then engage with it. Discuss, come afterwards, discuss with it, email me, talk to me on the phone. It's meant to be engaged with and discussed with, and meant to be practically acted upon. Because you see, brothers and sisters, there's something, sometimes you sit in a gathering and you hear something, but it's only over here. Something needs to happen for it to go from here into here. And even further, something needs to happen in order for it to go from here into here. This requires a work on your part. We are trying to do the work on our part. We hope that inshallah you will do your part as well. Living in a culture of instant gratification. At first glance, we might say that, what's the big deal? Isn't this a good thing that we are living in the new age, the modern era, where everything is available at the tips of our fingertips? Technology is there, which allows me to connect with my family halfway around the world. I can be sitting in the majlis, and on one hand, I can be listening to the lecture. On the other hand, if I get bored, I can just pop into my smartphone and check the news and the sports scores. Isn't this a good thing? Why is it that we have to discuss it and perhaps even critique it and criticize it? The point I want to make, first of all, is that we're not saying that everything about the culture that we're living in, or everything about this culture of instant gratification, is a bad thing. No. There are some good things about it. But when we go and examine the root of this culture, which is what? Which is that I, as an individual, can do or get whatever my soul or my nafs fancies, whatever it is that I desire, without waiting for it, instantly, the consequences of that are very severe. It changes the way that we think. It changes the way that we act. It changes the way that we are as well. You might say that, okay, no, it's not a big deal, but inshallah, I want to show over the nights that our being in this particular culture right here, which is a culture of people seeking instant gratification, the ramifications are so severe that if we don't speak about it and we're not aware of it and we just go with the flow and we just act and adopt this culture for ourselves as well too, the consequences can be so severe that it can lead to our abandoning the Islamic culture altogether. And that's the proposition that I want to make. Inshallah, we'll be proving that in the nights to come. The very values that we hold are threatened by this culture right here. Now, what is the solution to this? Inshallah, we're not just going to be critiquing it, we're going to be talking about how to address it. And I want to be optimistic here. The advice, I'm not going to be giving the advice that, okay, now that we're living in a culture where there are some things which take us away from God, therefore the answer is that we have to move away, we have to go back home. For many of us, what does that mean? It doesn't have a meaning. That's not the point here. The point is that I want to slowly be offering an alternative lifestyle, an alternative way of living, an alternative culture. And that is possible, that we can be in the society where there's a predominant culture which has values which are opposed to ours, yet we can maintain our own values. Now, one of the points that I'd like to give you as homework, inshallah, is something that I want you to be thinking about, is what is the name of that alternative culture that we want to propose? Okay, on one hand, we have the culture of instant gratification. There's another culture which is coming from within the Islamic teachings. I want you to think about what is the best name and label that we can give to that culture. Now, when we go to the Quran and the Ahadith, we see that there is guidance when it comes to this living in such a culture of instant gratification. One of the primary terms which is used to address this type of way of thinking and this type of lifestyle is that of ajal or ajalah. The Quran tells us in Surah Al-Isra, verse number 11, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وَيَدْعُ الْإِنسَانُ بِالشَّرِّ دُعَاءَهُ بِالْخَيْرِ وَكَانَ الْإِنسَانُ عَجُولًا. Allah says that human beings pray for evil the same way that they pray for good. And then He says that indeed the human being, one of the qualities of a human being, Allah created us, and He's saying that one of the qualities that we have is that we are ajul. Ajul doesn't just mean that we do things fast or we do things hastily. No, Allah is saying something beyond that. He's saying that one of the deep-seated qualities of a human being that we need to be aware of and we need to work against, we need to train ourselves not to fall into the trap of this, is that we have to avoid doing ajala. Now, ajala is typically translated as being hasty. But one of the things we're going to see is that it doesn't just mean to do things not at the right time, to do things at the wrong time. It doesn't mean just that. It applies to the way we think about things, the way we value things, the way we make our decisions as well too. Now, not only does the Quran address this concept specifically of living in a hasty, a very shallow, a very sort of materialistic way with this term ajul, but also the Quran gives us a living example of people who had this quality. What is this example? It's the example of the Bani Israel. Before I go into just a couple of points about their story, I want to mention a point here, which is that the stories of the Quran are not just stories. They're stories that are meant to be guidance for us as Muslims. Sometimes we come to these stories about Bani Israel and we think that, okay, maybe Allah is addressing the Bani Israel at the time of the Prophet who were also there and they were, you know, understanding and hearing about the revelation. No. Yes, they can benefit from the Quran being revealed and they might hear about these verses, but the verses of the Quran are for the people of the Quran who are the Muslims. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. With regards to the verse which says, لَتَرْكَبُنَّ طَبَقًا عَنْ طَبَقٍ, which means that you will surely fare and travel from stage to stage, he says that one of the applications of this verse is that we as Muslims will follow the same footsteps, I'm paraphrasing here, we'll take the same footstep and the same trends and the same stages that the previous nations went through, we as Muslims will go through the same as well too. So it's upon us to study their history and to avoid falling into the same pitfalls that they fell into. I'm going to give two examples from the life of Bani Israel which relate to our topic, living in a culture of instant gratification. The first one is from when they had been delivered from Fir'aun. They have crossed the river. Fir'aun and his army have been drowned. They pass now, they're victorious, they've just witnessed a miracle taken place, an incredible blessing of God that He's given them on the through the wasila of Nabi Musa alayhi salam. At this point now, they happen to pass by some people who are worshipping idols. Now a little bit of background here. Bani Israel were living with the people of Fir'aun, the Copts. And one of the things we understand from the Quran is that Fir'aun not only thought of himself as a god, but also he believed in idols as well too. Meaning that the people of Fir'aun were idol worshippers and they worshipped Fir'aun as one of the idols, the living idols. And the Bani Israel, despite living a life of Tawheed under the guidance of Nabi Musa alayhi salam, yet they were influenced by the culture that they were living in. They're passing by these group of people who are worshipping idols. And the Quran describes this. It says that in Surah Al-A'raf, وَجَاوَزْنَا بِبَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ الْبَحْرِ فَأَتَوْا عَلَىٰ قَوْمٍ يَعْكُفُونَ عَلَىٰ أَصْنَامٍ لَهُمْ قَالُوا يَا مُوسَىٰ اِجْعَلْ لَنَا إِلَٰهًا كَمَا لَهُمْ آلِهَا قَالَ إِنَّكُمْ قَوْمٌ تَجْهَلُونَ. They say to Nabi Musa, oh Nabi Musa, make us a god the same way that they have gods. They're impressed by that. You see, they're coming from a background where they, even though they didn't believe in idols, the people around them did, and they were influenced by that. And when the opportunity arises, they want those idols as well too. There's a lesson in that for us, a warning for us, that if we're in a society where the culture is going in a certain direction, we shouldn't imagine that we're immune from that just because we say we're Muslim. We have to take extra precaution, understand what it is that they're doing which is wrong, and protect ourselves from that. Second lesson that we have from the lives of Bani Israel. What happens now is that Nabi Musa alayhi salam is summoned by Allah for a special appointment. And he goes and he tells them that I'll be gone for 30 days. For 30 days he is gone. And that meeting then is extended for another 10 days. There is an opportunist among the Bani Israel whose name is Samiri. He seems to be some sort of magician. He comes up with a plot. He builds a calf out of the gold from the Bani Israel. He gathers their gold and he builds a calf that can make special noises. And he calls the Bani Israel to him. He says that your prophet is gone. Not sure when he's going to come back. Here you have a calf which makes a special noise. Come and worship this and take this as your God. He had seen the Bani Israel stumble just after they had crossed the sea. Now that their prophet wasn't among them, he knows that this is their weak point and he can get to them here. It's very interesting, this use of a calf. Why is it that Samiri uses a calf? What is a calf? A calf is a young cow. Now, one of the commentators of the Quran, who is a very famous scholar from the Hawza, his name is Al-Mustafawi, and he's the author of a linguistic work which is known as At-Tahqiq. He's a respected scholar. He says something interesting here. He says that the word used for calf is the word ajl. And the word ajl stems from the same root word as ajal or ajala that we had talked about just a little bit earlier. Why is that? In Arabic, you have words that come from the same root. Usually, they share some sort of meaning. What connection is there between a calf, and this thing of doing things hastily, without thought, in a shallow sort of way, in a materialistic sort of way? He explains that the connection is this, that a calf is an animal which has very fast and jerky movements. And therefore, it is related to this concept of doing things in a fast sort of way. And he goes on to say that the Bani Israel were people who were very much attracted towards things which glitter and things which had this type of fast response and instant gratification for them. They weren't willing to wait for Nabi Musa even one more day. And so when they see this calf, which represents the type of ideals that they themselves hold, doing things fast in a glitzy and glittery sort of way, there's a lot of synergy between the two. And that's why they take this calf as an object of worship. When Nabi Musa alayhi salam returns, look at how he addresses his people. He's very disappointed with them. He says to them, وَلَمَّا رَجَعَ مُوسَىٰ إِلَىٰ قَوْمِهِ غَضْبَانْ أَسِفَ قَالَ بِئْسَ مَا خَلَفْتُمُونِي مِنْ بَعَدِي أَعَجِلْتُمْ أَمْرَ رَبِّكُمْ. He accuses them of something. What does he say to them? He says that, will you hasten on the edict of your Lord? Clearly, he's saying that one of the qualities of the Bani Israel is that they were people who were hasty. They weren't people who made their decisions based on thought and reason. They were people who wanted quick results, and therefore they went for this calf right here. There's more that we can say if we were to study the story of Bani Israel, but we'll confine ourselves with that for now, for today. I want to, in the remainder of the speech before we move to the Masab, I want to just address this gathering that we have here. Why is it that we're here? And this is something that we have to do, brothers and sisters. I remember one time we went to a bakery back in Qum, and it was very interesting for me to see them making bread and the way they were doing it. I remember there was somebody there, and as he was making the bread, he had a special type of dance that he was doing while he was making this bread. It was very curious and peculiar. I hadn't seen it at other bakeries, but I saw it with this person right here. So one of the people asked him, he says, why is it that you're doing things in this way? Why is it that you're dancing in this particular way? He says, well, this is the way that I learned how to do this particular job that I do in order to make the bread. This is the way my teacher did it as well too. Why does he do it? Well, that's the way that his teacher did it. Well, why is it that he did it? Well, I don't know. That's just the way it's done. Now, when it comes to the majalis of Imam Hussein Islam, is it that we should just say that, okay, it's being done just because that's the way it's being done, or do we have to understand why it's being done the way it's being done? I want to just go and address a couple of those important questions that we have to ask of why and give those answers, inshallah. Number one is that, okay, somebody might say that 12 nights, and then even beyond that as well too, you know, I'm living in a time where, you know, I just don't have time anymore. This culture doesn't give me enough time to spend, to actually take out of my schedule, to go to the center. You know, maybe I'll come a couple of times. That's enough, right? After all, it's the same story being told. Or I might say, okay, no, I'm not going to come. I'll just like tune in online. You know, what is the point of actually coming to the gathering right here? Right? These are the type of things that can happen. People start to think, and they do think, and they act upon this as well too. Brothers and sisters, coming to the gathering, participating in the majlis is of supreme importance. What we're doing here is part of a tradition which is centuries old. And this is the backbone of which has been carrying forward the true message of Islam all these years, brothers and sisters. The importance cannot be underestimated. We shouldn't make excuses for ourselves. One of the points I wanted to mention is that one of the secrets of success of some of the great individuals that we have has been their participation in the majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. One of my teachers was telling me a story once. He was saying that Allama Tabatabai, rahmatullahi alayhi, he was a busy person. Right? We're busy, but he was a busy person. He had taken it upon himself to perform this monumental task of writing a commentary on the Qur'an, the likes of which had never been seen before in history, in Shia or Sunni schools of thought. He was a busy person, but yet he would make a point to go to the Rosa and the Majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And there was a point where he became a famous individual. He became known as Allama Tabatabai. And he knew that if he would go to a gathering, then there would be a lot of fanfare. And people would say that, why don't you come and sit at the front of the majlis? And he wasn't somebody to want that additional attention. So he had a perfect excuse for not going to the majlis. A divine, you could say that for the sake of God, I'm not going to go. But he still went. And what he would do, he would take his abba, and then he would go and he would put it over his head and enter the gathering. I don't know if you've seen this. If you ever walk through the streets of Qum, sometimes you see that there's these men, typically elderly men, especially if it's cold outside, they'll be walking and they'll have this over their heads. And sometimes you're not sure, is it a man or a woman, until you see the beard poking out from underneath, and you know, okay, this is a hajjah, this is one of the men, this is the woman. He would go in with the abba wrapped over his head and sit quietly in the corner, and nobody would notice him. And then until afterwards, and maybe then he would reveal, and then they'll be like, oh, Allama Tabatabai came to our gathering here. But still he would go. And he would go and he would participate, and his students say that sometimes we could see his entire body shaking out of the tears that he would be shedding for Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam. This same Allama Tabatabai says, quoting from his teacher Sayyid Qadi, that there is no way that somebody can get to God and take the path to God without the help of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam. This is the secret of success. Why is it that we do it though? Right? Another thing that somebody might say is that, okay, fine, we're here to learn from the messages of Imam Hussein. We're here to hear the lessons of him. Why don't we have gatherings and academic type of discussions? Why is it that we do things in this way with shedding tears? And this is an important question to ask. You see, brothers and sisters, there's a time and a place for everything. There's a time and place where we discuss things at an academic level, do analysis, you know, debate, discuss, make strategy. But when it comes to this particular event, it's not enough just to discuss it at an academic level. You see, brothers and sisters, there's a time when you can plant some seeds into the ground. But that itself isn't going to do the job of causing the seeds to grow into anything. You need to have the water as well too, that will be the factor that will cause the actual growing to take place. You need the sunlight as well too. You need these other factors that will be there which actually cause these things to actually take root. It's the same thing, that this knowledge that we have, a lot of times we know what's right and what's wrong. We've heard these things so many times in our lives. But yet, if we don't have the inspiration to act upon them, then we're not going to do it. Where do we get that inspiration from? Where do we get that fuel from? We get it from those tears that we shed when we remember Imam Hussein alayhi salam. It's very important, it's essential that we have exactly these types of gatherings. But that we should do so in the right sort of way. You see, when we gather here, all of us are taking part in this responsibility that we have from the Ahlul Bayt of commemorating what took place. They were the ones who initiated this. When you go to the seerah of the Ahlul Bayt, we see that immediately after the tragedy of Karbala, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, he institutes azadari. He is the one who holds majalis, and the women folk of the Bani Hashim participate as well too. After him, we have traditions which say that Imam Bakr alayhi salam used to have majalis as well too. After him, Imam Salik, Imam Kadhim, Imam Ridha alayhi salam, all the way until the Imam of our time, we have indications that he too as well has these type of mourning sessions. But his mourning, in our mourning, it's of a different nature. We shed tears, but he sheds tears of blood. This is the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, and they've given us a responsibility to carry this forward. So we have to do it, and we have to do it in the right way as well too. What are some things that we can keep in mind as to how we should effectively carry the message of Imam Hussein? It's not just one way or the other way. Sometimes people say that, okay, well, why is it that you do things in this way? Why is it that you beat your chest? Why is it that you have certain, you know, things hung up on the wall, that you wear black clothing? Are all of these found in hadith? Okay, and this type of approach to Islam is not the right approach, that everything has to be found in hadith, literally. Because Islam is a set of principles and rules that are meant to be applied in different times and different places. What we have to look for is the principles that the Ahlul Bayt gave us to be able to commemorate the tragedy of Karbala. What are those principles? Number one is that when it comes to these gatherings, we should make sure that the way that we commemorate it, through our art, through our poetry, through our ritual and mourning and our matam, etc., we should make sure that the spirit is in line with the ideals of azadari practiced by the Ahlul Bayt. What are the things that we get from the way they used to do it? Number one is that it's something which is sacred. Number two, that it's filled with emotion and grief. This is the way that we should do what we're doing. So when we come here, we should make it a point that when it comes time for the masab, when it comes time for the marthiya, the matam, whatever it is that we're doing, the silent vigils, the poetry, whatever else that we want to do, we should make sure that we do so in a grieving sort of way. That's why the request is that we make a point to cast our heads down when it's appropriate to do so. We make a point to try to cause tears to come to our eyes. We're told in hadith that if you can't cry, then try to make yourself cry. Because that itself can help you cry. Crying is something which is divinely inspired. But at least by putting ourselves in that situation where we're praying to Allah to get those tears to come down from our eyes, inshallah Allah will respond as well too. But let's make a point to at least try by casting our heads down and grieving at the right times. Number two is that the ritual itself, the performance of the ritual, should not overtake the purpose behind which it is being performed. This is very important. There are a lot of factors that come into play when doing a ritual. For example, if you're doing something melodious, the tune that you use. Right? If you're doing something like that, then what year was it? Is it something new or something that people have heard before? Etc. What's catchy, what's not catchy? There's a lot of different things that you can look at. But we shouldn't get caught up in these things. What's important is the message that's being conveyed and the purpose behind which is being done. I shouldn't be looking and seeing and making my decisions based on what's catchy, what's more sing-songy. No, the goal is to commemorate what took place in a sacred display of emotion and grief. And number three, these are from the teachings of the fatawa of the maraji and from the teachings of the ulama. They say that number three is that what we do should not cause the image of Muslims or the madhab of Shia or the event of Karbala to be weakened in any way whatsoever. And this is very important, because sometimes I might want to commemorate something in a certain way, but without being looking at it deeply, and without thinking about it, I might actually be causing harm to the cause and standing opposed to the message of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam, which is our responsibility to convey with others. So all those who are participating in the form of poetry and artwork and matam and marsha, whatever it is that we're doing, volunteering, all of you should know that you're doing something which is incredibly valuable. Those of you who are not, just by coming and wearing your black clothing and participating and shedding tears, you too are also part of fulfilling this responsibility that we have from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Please recite salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. On this night of the first of Muharram, we wish to commemorate one of those events from Karbala and from those events that took place prior to Karbala, which represent a poignant moment for the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and serve as a cause of grief for us as their followers. When the letter was sent to the governor of Medina that take the allegiance of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, and if he refuses, then send me back his head. At this point, Imam Hussein receives word of what's going to happen. He realizes that his responsibility at this point is to leave the city of Medina, the Medina of his grandfather, the Prophet. The Medina which had been the safe haven of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. That Medina from which the Prophet had reigned over the Ummah and had accomplished a miracle in the span of only 10 years. That Medina which the Ahlul Bayt held so dear to them, he would now have to leave that city. We're told according to riwayat that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, in order to perform this difficult task, he goes to the grave of his grandfather and he begins to address him. You see, brothers and sisters, this is the way that the Ahlul Bayt are. Then when difficulties come up, they turn to the Prophet. Imam Ali alayhi salam says that when difficulties will come to us in battle, when the situation would become very dire and we wouldn't know what to do, how we would win over the enemy, we would seek refuge in whom? We would seek refuge in the Prophet. And with him and his solace and his comfort, we would find victory over the enemy. This is the way the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam were. This is the way that we are to be as well. He goes to the grave of the Prophet and he begins speaking with him. We're told that he was there at night and until the point where he begins to nod away, and suddenly he sees in a mukashafa, in a spiritual revelation, he sees that the Prophet is there in front of him. The Prophet would not leave the one who calls him unanswered. He's talking to him, he's consoling him, he takes him and brings him to his chest and kisses his forehead. And he tells him that, Oh Hussein, you have something to accomplish here. That for you there are degrees of spirituality that are reserved for you, solely for you, but you cannot reach them except through your shahada. And Allah desires that you should take your women folk and your children as well. And Allah desires that they too should be martyred and they too should be taken captive. This is your task, Oh Hussein. Imam Hussein al-Islam is readying his family now to leave. They are in a state of grief. They are crying. They say that this is so severe for us, as if it's that day that Fatimah al-Zahra sallallahu alayhi passed away. As if it's the day that Amir al-Mu'mineen passed away. As if it's the day that Imam Hassan passed away. As if it's the day that our grandfather, the Prophet, departed from this world. This is how hard this day is for us. Sakina, the daughter of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, she says that no family has ever been more scared or more fearful than the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam were on that day as they are leaving Medina. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. As-salamu alayka ayyuhal atashan wa bi Karbala. Our peace and blessings to you, O Imam.
Imam Hussein, the one who was slain on the banks of the Euphrates River, while his lips were thirsty of water. O Sakina, you are fearful right now as you leave Medina, but with you you have such an array of helpers. You have Abbas, the brother of Hussein. You have Imam Hussein alayhi salam with you. You have Ali Akbar. You have so many helpers and companions. But one day the same caravan which is now departing Medina will come back to Medina. Where is Abbas? Where is Ali Akbar? Where is Qasim? Where is your father Hussein? When that caravan is about to enter Medina, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam tells Bashir, O Bashir, tell the people of Medina to be ready for us. Announce to them what took place with us in Karbala. Bashir is a poet. He stands up and addresses them. He tells them, Ya ahla yathriba la muqama lakum biha. قتل الحسين فادمعي مدرارا. O people of Medina, this is no longer the place for you to stay. Hussein has been killed, so let every eye weep with tears. الجسم منه بكربلا مدرج. That pure body of Hussein has become stained with his own blood in Karbala. The sister of Imam Hussein, Umm Kulthum, is now entering Medina. She addresses Medina in her poetry. She says, Medina tu jaddina la taqbalina, fa bil hasarati wal ahzani ji'na. We come to you, O the city of my grandfather, with all grief and regret. Allah fa akhbir Rasulullah anna. Tell my grandfather what took place to us. بِأَنَّا قَدْ فُجِعْنَا فِي أَبِينَا. How we suffered on account of our father. وَأَنَّ رِجَالَنَا بِالطَّفِّ صَرْعَى. Our men are now lying on the ground of Karbala. بِلَا رُؤْسٍ وَقَدْ ذَبَحُوا الْبَنِينَ. They are lying there, their heads have been cut off. Our children have been murdered. وَأَخْبِرْ جَدَّنَا أَنَّا أُسِرْنَا. And tell our grandfather that we were taken prisoners. وَبَعَدَ الْأَسْرِيَا جَدَّا سُبِينَا. And after we were taken prisoner, they looted us. أَلَّا لَعَنَةُ اللَّهِ عَلَى الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ. مَعْتَمِ حُسَيْنَ.